TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. War and Fleas: How Economic Shock Therapy Backfired in Iraq. Naomi Klein is the author of the bestseller No Logo, that was translated into 27 languages. She writes an internationally syndicated column for The Nation, The Guardian, and The Globe and Mail. When she spoke in Oakland, California, in February 2005, the results of the Iraqi elections had just been announced. You are about to hear how the IMF, the U.S. government, the Paris Club, and other international organizations are making a cruel joke of the promise of democracy and self-determination. Here is Naomi Klein.
I've talked to many friends in the U.S. who just are so bombarded with this media propaganda about what the elections mean that it's almost left them speechless. Some of them have lost their own convictions. This is not a time for us to lose our bearings. It is not a time for us to be speechless. Our job is clear. Our job is to say it is about what you voted for. Elections are not performance art. To back up the demands for troop withdrawal. Of course, as soon as Iraqis had come back from the polls, we immediately heard from Bush, these elections clearly show that there can be no troop withdrawal. So Iraqis vote for troop withdrawal, and that means no troop withdrawal. Blair, he thought that elections were, he said, magnificent. But of course, a timetable is not on the agenda. Now we need to back up the demands for troop withdrawal, and we also need to back up the economic demands as well. The occupation of Iraq is not just about the presence of troops. There are all these other ways that the country is being occupied. Now, I said I was going to talk about how Iraqis have been demanding democracy really from the moment the country was invaded. There was this explosion of democratic desire. We saw it with hundreds of newspapers being published in the months after the occupation, new political parties starting, independent trade unions forming, like the Southern Oil Workers Union, which now has 23,000 members. All of these demands came into direct conflict with the reason the war was waged. Now, we always talk about the reason it wasn't waged. We talk about the lack of weapons of mass destruction and the lack of an al-Qaeda link, and we sort of laugh at the idea that it was about democracy. If we want to know what the war was about, all we have to do is look at the actions of Paul Bremer in the first 6 months of the occupation. It isn't a secret. It isn't a conspiracy. He did what he did. He did what the war was for. He was very, very open about it. He turned Iraq into a sort of capitalist utopia, a free market laboratory. I always think that it wasn't a coincidence that the first year of Iraq's occupation was the year that reality TV shows about extreme makeovers exploded. So you had all of these shows on American television that were these incredibly intense makeover shows. They just kept raising the bar, you know, The Swan, where you would have plastic surgery, and these extreme home renovation shows where they would just bulldoze your entire house and rebuild the house from scratch. I'm sure many of you don't waste any time watching these terrible programs, but it's really a phenomenon. It's the American dream just taken to absolute extremes, the American dream of total reinvention. So I just somehow think that it's fitting that, you know, this was entertainment, and then news was extreme makeover Iraq, right? The idea was the worse the better, right? I mean, think about Donald Rumsfeld in those early days. While Iraq's museums and libraries were being looted, the cradle of civilization, he's asked about it in a press conference, and he says, stuff happens, right? Stuff happens, because the worse the better, right? The more destruction, the better. The most dangerous myth of all time, redemptive violence. And Paul Bremer was the sort of overlord of extreme makeover Iraq, right? But he also had teams of experts. And that's the way he behaved. The first thing he did is he laid off 500,000 people. Everything must go. They called it debathification. What it actually was a total attack on the public sector. Now, Iraq's army cannot be saved. We'll fire them all and we'll start over from scratch. That's worked incredibly well, as you can see. He also announced, even though he'd never been to Iraq before, that Iraq's entire economy was Stalinist and there was absolutely nothing salvageable. The whole thing had to go. He would sell off all 200 of Iraq's state-owned companies. He made this announcement in June of 2003. He arrived in May. To attract foreign investors, he rewrote Iraq's constitution, just tore the whole thing up, and wrote what The Economist magazine described as the wish list for foreign investors. So we don't have to guess at what the goals of the war were. We see them in the construction of enduring military bases. We see them in the announcements of the privatization of the entire economy. We see it when George Bush announced, 5 days after the so-called end of official fighting, 5 days after the mission accomplished moment, that he planned to create a free trade zone for all of the Middle East. So we don't have to speculate and we don't need conspiracy theories. We can judge them by their actions. The problem became that Iraqis didn't react like contestants on an extreme makeover television show and look in the mirror and go, oh my God, I love my brand new country. They acted as if their country was being looted, which it was. They acted as if their jobs were being stolen. They acted as if their expertise, their PhDs, were being ignored so Bechtel and Halliburton engineers could come in and show them how it would be done. And of course, we've seen how these guys were supposed to be the absolute best of the best, the most efficient. And in fact, they've just been pictures of the most incredible inefficiency that you could ever ask for. I mean, Iraqis have lost faith in the private sector because they have learned about the wonders of capitalism from Halliburton and Bechtel, who, you know, wander the country when they leave the green zone like these giant lumbering beasts, surrounded by their mercenary soldiers, unable to move in their armed convoys, spending now more than half of their budgets that are supposed to go to reconstruction on life insurance policies and mercenary soldiers to protect them from Iraqis. These are the people, not to mention the inflated salaries to begin with of importing all of your workers from abroad. These are the people that were supposed to teach Iraqis about the efficiencies of the free market. And then there's the corruption. So as Iraqis started to resist the extreme makeover through various means, not just the armed resistance, but by staging, for instance, wildcat strikes. The southern oil workers staged a three-week-long strike that shut down the oil industry. It was barely reported. Staging all kinds of strikes against the layoffs, publishing very critical articles in their newly freed press, we started to see how shallow that commitment to freedom and democracy actually was. That's when the delays in the planned elections started to come. Because originally, the first plan was to hand over power directly to an elected Iraqi government. That's what Donald Rumsfeld said would happen immediately after the invasion. This plan was delayed, and they announced that they would actually have to appoint an interim government. And that's what we've been seeing now since June 30th, the appointed government of Iyad Alawi. All of these delays happened for a reason. It wasn't that it was bad planning or that they didn't have an exit strategy or it was some sort of a management error. It was that the goals of the occupation, the reason the war was waged, and there were multiple reasons, but this is part of the reason the war was waged, was that it was fundamentally incompatible with democracy, and that became clear very, very quickly. And as that became clear, a war was waged on the freedoms that had been promised. It wasn't just about elections being delayed. It was also a war against independent journalists. We just saw the director of news for CNN forced to resign because he happened to tell the truth at Davos, which apparently you're not allowed to do. He said that journalists in Iraq are not just collateral damage. They are targeted. This is a fact. It is not CNN reporters who are being targeted. It's, for the most part, independent Arabic journalists who are being targeted, working particularly for Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. On April the 8th, the day that Baghdad was being very heavily bombed, the day before Baghdad fell, an Al Jazeera reporter was on the roof of the offices of the station's Baghdad office. They'd given the coordinates to the Pentagon. They knew exactly where they were, and the Al Jazeera reporter was bombed live on the air. On that same day, a U.S. tank fired at the Palestine Hotel and killed a Reuters reporter and a Spanish reporter for Telecinco, and his family is suing the U.S. government for war crimes. So what Ethan Jordan said is nothing that any journalists who are reporting from Iraq don't know. So in this interim period where elections were delayed, where they got their appointed government, they've been very, very busy. And what they've been doing is they've been finding all of these ingenious ways to lock in Paul Bremer's extreme makeover. The reason the elections were delayed is because democracy is fundamentally incompatible with these goals, and we see that when we look at what Iraqis actually voted for. So how have they tried to lock it in? We really need to pay attention to this because this is what the next phase is going to be all about. Now, I said that Iraqis voted not to pay Saddam's debts, and that is an absolutely principled position. There is precedent for people in countries in transitions like this from an oppressive regime to a newly so-called democratic one to declare those debts odious and refuse to pay. There is precedent. They could make that case, and it would in fact be very, very hard for the Bush administration to fight that case publicly because they have said the same things. When James Baker was appointed envoy, George Bush said that this was a sacred mission, a noble mission, because the Iraqi people should not have to pay the debts of their dictator, and he was absolutely right. Of course, he didn't mean it, and neither did James Baker, because what they've actually done is they have taken a debt load, which is at approximately $120 billion. Now, that makes Iraq the most heavily indebted country per capita in the world. When you have a country that is that heavily indebted, it's a much bigger problem for the people who hold that debt than it is for the country with that debt, because it is simply unpayable. You can't pay it. The IMF has assessed Iraq's debt and declared it an unsustainable debt. So we know that they can't pay the debt. Yet they entered into an agreement with the International Monetary Fund in order to get more money. So what the occupation has done is not alleviated Iraq's debt, but push Iraq further into debt. They got a new IMF loan for $500 million, which was tied to a structural adjustment program, which called for the privatization of all the state companies, austerity on social spending in a country facing a profound humanitarian crisis. And worse than that, they called for the elimination of Iraq's food ration program, on which 60% of the country depends for basic nutrition. Then there was a negotiation with the Paris Club group of industrialized countries, which are the 19 industrialized countries that get together to come up with a single policy on debt when they all hold part of a country's debts. So you probably heard about these negotiations because they were heralded as a great victory for the Iraqi people. What actually happened was they took this unsustainable debt, which Iraqis have said they don't want to pay, that they don't believe they need to pay, that Bush has said they don't need to pay, and they wrote it down by 80% so that they would have to pay 20%, which means that they took an unsustainable debt and made it sustainable, i.e. payable. Okay? So they made sure that they would, in fact, pay that debt, and then they tied them to a three-stage program where they said, we will write down the debt, not all right away, but we'll write down some of it now, some of it in 2005, and the rest of it in 2008, depending on whether Iraq follows the IMF structural adjustment program. So even though Iraqis voted to create all of these jobs in the public sector, right? Remember that plan, a job for every fit Iraqi? Well, what privatization of Iraq's state-owned companies means is that two-thirds of the workers in these factories, and I got this from the Minister of Industry himself, and I got it confirmed by people within the occupation authority, it means that two-thirds of the people working at those 200 state firms will lose their jobs because they've assessed these companies and found that, in their view, in order for them to be sold, they would have to be downsized ahead of time, that nobody would want to buy a company that was that, in their view, overstaffed. So rather than getting the full employment that they voted for, rather than treating the reconstruction of Iraq as their new deal, a huge public works program, putting Iraqis to work, rebuilding bridges, rebuilding roads, using the country's expertise, they're deepening the process of privatization, which is going to deepen an unemployment crisis, which by some measures is already at 70%. So that's what it means to shackle the country to this IMF program. The other decision that they made was to write an interim constitution, while the country was under occupation. Now, this was rejected by Iraqis at the time. There were huge protests, 100,000 people on the streets of Baghdad in January 2004 shouting, "Yes, yes, elections, no, no, selection." They said a constitution should be written after the elections by the people who were elected. Apparently, they needed to go back to democracy school. They didn't understand the principles. So Paul Bremer oversaw the writing of Iraq's constitution with the help of Noah Feldman, an NYU professor who'd never been to Iraq. And they included a clause, Clause 26, which said that the next government of Iraq, the interim government, could not change, amend, or rescind any of Paul Bremer's 100 orders, laws, in any way. That was the interim government. Now, Iraq has an elected government. They say that the only way they can change or amend these laws now is if they get 3/4 of the votes on the National Assembly. Now, the United Iraqi Alliance only got 51% of the vote. The Kurdish parties got 26. So you can see that getting that 3/4 that's required to change any of Paul Bremer's laws is going to be next to impossible. In addition, they created a 3-person presidential council, and now there's a lot of wrangling about who's going to be on that council. But there's definitely going to be a leadership role for somebody from one of the Kurdish parties who's very, very close to the United States. They say in order for them to amend any of Bremer's laws, they need 3/4 of the assembly and unanimity on the presidential council. So actually, it's harder than any country in the world to change any of these laws. This is what democracy in Iraq means. Now, when Iraqis went to the polls, they told people who asked them, they were asked, what are the most pressing issues for you? And not surprisingly, they said things like water, electricity. That's why we're voting, to meet our basic needs, economic rights as well as voting rights and individual rights. Well, just a few days before the elections, another huge contract was given out to Bechtel without any discussion of what that meant in this context. They gave another company to rebuild the water system. So what that means in practice is that when Iraqis still don't have water in a couple of years from now, when they're still dealing with cholera-infested water, and they go to the politicians who they elected, and they say, "We have a crisis," they're going to be told by their politicians that it's actually not in their hands, that it's Bechtel that's controlling it, and that it's the U.S. Embassy that continues to hold the vast majority of this $18.4 billion that was supposedly a gift to the Iraqi people to rebuild their country. They've only spent $1.5 billion of that money. And we never really hear analysis about why that is. Once again, it's portrayed as bad management. They can't administer it. What's taking so long? It's slow. It's not a mistake. It's that money is power. And by holding on to that money, which is the only money that's being allotted to rebuild Iraq's devastated infrastructure, water, electricity, roads, it means that the U.S. Embassy inside the Green Zone still has all of this power over the most basic services in Iraq. So what we're talking about is fundamental to democracy, to our definition of democracy, because we know that voting is not democracy, that elections are not democracy, that water is also democracy, that the ability to be the authors of your country's destiny is democracy. And that's what's being systematically eroded in Iraq. I was doing some research about the agricultural sector, because one of the things that's happening in Iraq right now is it's been made totally dependent on foreign imports, particularly from the United States, for food. Now, Iraq used to have a thriving agricultural sector, and now it's totally dependent on foreign imports, which is really good for the countries that are occupying it, because they've really cornered the market, particularly U.S. and Australia, who are sending lots and lots of wheat to Iraq at monopoly prices. So I went to visit a research farm on the outskirts of Baghdad that's associated with Baghdad University to talk to people about the situation in agriculture. And of course, the obstacles to rebuilding the sector are massive. There's depleted uranium in the soil, and there are landmines everywhere. But no resources have been devoted to, for instance, demining in Iraq. And when I was in this research field, there was just one lone woman with a demining device. She was scanning the field to try to find landmines. And he told me that the students had pooled their money to pay for this with their own money so that they could start using these fields again. And I actually keep thinking about this image of this lone deminer in the field as I think about what has been done to Iraq's political landscape. You know, everything I'm describing here, holding on to the money, to the reconstruction money, and now they've asked for more, the IMF deal, the Paris Club deal, the constitution that locks in Paul Bremer's economic reforms, the veto, the effective veto that's been given to the Kurds so that they can reject the proposed constitution. All of these are unexploded ordinances in the political landscape so that when people try to act on the democracy that has been promised, they will meet with these little explosions. They will be told, sorry, you joined the World Trade Organization while you were under occupation, and you're locked into TRIPS, so you can't have autonomy over your agricultural policy. Or if they decide that they want to have an economic law that allows foreign companies to own only 49% of the assets in the country and not 100%, they'll face another explosion, another bomb will go off, and they'll find out that they can't do that. So if there is a job to do for the anti-war movement, I think what we need to be is deminers. We need to be like that woman in the field finding these unexploded ordinances and disarming them. Because, of course, the clocks have all been set here. The clocks have been set in Europe, and they've been set in Washington. They're not controlled in Iraq. So this is somewhere where I think we can have tremendous influence. And my politics really come out of the movement against neoliberalism, against savage capitalism, and the protests that we saw at the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, because we understand that these are global policies. We understand that this is how democracy is shackled around the world. And I think we've lost far too much of that economic analysis and that deep definition of democracy. I think our movements against capitalism were weakened by having an insufficient analysis of war, an insufficient understanding of the role of force required to enforce these policies. But I also think that our anti-war activism has been weakened by our insufficient analysis of economics and what war serves. So we need to be deminers, and we need to disarm these unexploded ordinances before they blow up. We need to join with Iraqis and try to create the space for them to act on their democratic wishes. It's a sort of a humble movement. It is not mimicking the imperial patterns of our rulers where we say, we know what's best for you, we've figured it out, and we'll only support your fight against the occupation if you follow our values. But what we do is we create the space for democracy to be a reality, because we know that democracy needs space. We try to pick some of these locks in all of these ways that they've tried to lock in their reforms. We can pick these locks. Because the fact is that all of these laws were written under occupation, which means that they're illegal. They're illegal under the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Regulations. These deals that were signed with the International Monetary Fund and the Paris Club violate the most basic principles of self-determination. But when Iraqis try to do this, we'll hear that they are terrorists, we'll hear that they don't really believe in democracy, and if they try to tear up Paul Bremer's constitution, we will hear that this was going to be the last election they ever had, and this will be used to justify more force in that country. So I think that we have our work cut out for us, and the goal of that work, I think, is to teach the people who wage these wars as they get ready for new ones that it doesn't pay. I think that's the best way to fight current wars and fight future wars at the same time, because we know that there were goals attached to this war, and we know that Iraqis have been fighting with everything they have to try to prevent those goals from being achieved. They've been fighting the military occupation. They've been resisting the construction of the enduring military bases. They've been fighting the attempts to privatize and sell off and loot their economy. If we can join with them and force the withdrawal of troops and prevent the construction of these enduring military bases, and we can also prevent Iraq from being this free market laboratory and being sold off to foreign corporations, then it really will not be worth it for them. It really will not have been worth it for them. And I think denying them, depriving them of the goals of war, is actually the best way of preventing the next war. I think that they can deal with a Middle East that descends into chaos, into violence and fascism. I don't think that was plan A, but I think that they can deal with it as plan B. The real threat, and we see this all along, the real threat is a self-governing Iraq that is genuinely free of them. So I think as we develop our new strategies for this much more complex stage, what we need to remember is what we're fighting for. The goal is not only for Bush to fail, but for the Iraqi people to win. So we have our work cut out for us, and despair is not an option. Thank you.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour speech by Naomi Klein, the Canadian author of No Logo and former fellow at the London School of Economics. Naomi Klein is also an award-winning journalist. She writes for The Nation, The Guardian, and The Globe and Mail. You can find more information on Naomi Klein on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs section. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour talk by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. This talk by Naomi Klein is also available as a DVD. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape, CD, or DVD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.